welcome to the Foodie Flashback. That is the podcast where we talk about food and about the memories associated with that. This is episode number 6, and I have a very special guest this time. Someone I haven't been on a podcast for a while, and I don't know, what was it, last year we met last time? I think it was last year. Pretty sure.
Yeah, I think it was still 2019.
Yeah,
I want to say it was like the summer.
Yeah, feels like another decade almost.
I know. It does. It feels like it's been longer than it has.
Definitely,
yeah. But yeah, I think the last time we saw, I could check my Instagram history or something, but I want to guess like August, somewhere around there.
No, it was before.
It was right before you left.
Yeah.
Right before you got married.
Like June, right July or something, June, July, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, so like maybe, we got Melissa here, the McMommy.
Hi. Good to be here.
So, yeah, I mean, like as I said, like we have done podcasts before. You are to some extent a podcaster. I don't know. Have you released anything recently?
Oh, yeah. I do the geekiest show ever over on the MyMac Network. And nice. We do that every other week, every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So that's been pretty regular. Yeah, mm-hmm. that's not safe for work show, to say no.
Well, yeah, we need those too, and especially right now. So, yeah. So I don't know where we're going to jump in. I mean, I know quite a bit about you, but then there are a lot of mysteries. Yeah. So I think, I mean, I know that you like grew up in a like Italian family, but kind of. Mm-hmm. So where do we start there? I mean, food in Italy, that's like a whole separate story, I want to say. Like we could like probably write books and like have another series just about Italians and food.
Oh, yeah, because they love their food. Everybody loves their food.
Absolutely, they do. Yeah, I have friends down there. So, I mean, how was that for you? Like, how important was food when you grew up?
When I was growing up, food was a very staple kind of ritualized kind of a thing because every Sunday we had spaghetti every single Sunday, and it kind of always followed this kind of scope and sequence. And there were definitely, I would say, gendered and hierarchy kind of a role, you know, growing up. So it's my mother's side that's the Italian side, and my dad's side is the German, and, you know, we're kind of a Heinz 57 variety mix of people. And there's German and Irish on my grandmother's side as well. But it's my grandfather that's the Italian. Mm-hmm. So he was born in America, but his parents immigrated here. Mm-hmm. So I guess that makes us like third generation Italian or something. Yeah. And so growing up, we always had Sunday dinners, if you will. You know, and when I say dinner, I'm meaning like Sunday was that day where you only had this one big, huge meal in the middle of the day.
Mm-hmm. And like the entire family came together, like everybody, like whatever, nieces and aunts and uncles and like everybody.
It was primarily, I guess, because there was a lot of church in my upbringing. So we kind of like the church was like our second home. So my grandmother was, for instance, she was the preschool teacher for like 60 some years. You know, my mother taught, you know, first and third grade or something. For me growing up, like I'm not really associated with religion nowadays, but growing up, like, church was my second school. Like I went to Sunday school just as regularly as I did regular academic school. And so the church was a big thing. So Sundays, we always, you know, got together and did church things. And whether it was Sunday school or, you know, my mom would prepare lessons, my grandmother would, you know, they would all have these different functions and stuff. And so it was always kind of like church. And then we'd all kind of go home, change out of our Sunday clothes, and then we'd go back to my grandparents' house. Now everybody lives within a couple of minutes away from each other. Everybody's kind of very close, and just everybody's in this is from back east in Pennsylvania. When you're born Italian. There, you live there, you die there.
Yeah, it's very
unless
very,
you're me.
Well, also very Italian, I want to say. Like, I mean, staying kind of in the same like same general area, like even the same village sometimes for generations, and coming together like for Sunday dinner.
And I would say that it was usually the same kind of cast of characters. And there was always like my aunts were always there. There were some people that lived a little bit further away, so they didn't visit all of the time. But we definitely had, you know, Thanksgiving and you know, traditional holidays and stuff there. But it was just this tiny little house. And when I was a little kid, I remember thinking it was much larger than it actually is. Like when I go back to visit, it's like, wow, this is a tiny little living room. This is a tiny little dining room. And yet we fit so many people in there, and it never felt really that crowded. But when when Sunday rolled around, it was always the time where, like I said, we go to church and then we'd all go back to my grandparents' house and the cooking would begin, you know, mm-hmm. the meal prep. And so when you say how important was food, it was like everything kind of centered around that meal. And then once we had that meal, and there were like certain kind of rituals that I'll get into in a second mm-hmm. that were part of that meal. And then after that meal, it was like, that's when the men would like retire to the living room. Now, mm-hmm. because it was such a small house, like, you know how you don't realize things when you're little and then you grow up and yeah. you look back and you think, oh, yeah, that's totally. Why they did it that way. Yeah. You know, like, now it makes sense. So it was actually a very small home. And so there wasn't as much room at the table. Like mm-hmm. in the dining room is where we would have like the extended family. So like mm-hmm. when cousins and other people came over, mm-hmm. then we'd extend it out into the dining room. But for mm-hmm. the most part, we all ate around the kitchen. So it was mm-hmm. the kitchen table and the dining room table. Mm-hmm. You know, it's got lots of tables, lots of places, you know, lots of horizontal surfaces for which to place food. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that involved like a TV tray or something. But it was very gendered, I would say, because, you know, the men were kind of prioritized and they sat in the living room. They got mm-hmm. they got to eat in the living room, you know, so to speak. And the women would stay in the dining room and in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. So, of course, you know, we would do the dishes. So, like, I remember, you know, I have fond memories of growing up, you know, that's when the women would kind of like get together and talk and we would all do dishes. We didn't have a dishwasher back then. Mm-hmm. So it was a combination of hand washing and then dish yeah. drying. Mm-hmm. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So I should actually go back to the meal portion of it. So the memories that I have associated with it, of course, first is the smell, you know, just the mm-hmm. smell of, you know, so when you go back to the house, you know, after you've changed out your clothes and you come back to the house, you smell the smell of the pasta cooking, like the water boiling, mm-hmm. you know, you hear the water boiling, you smell the pasta cooking, and then you smell the spices and the sauce, you know, the mm-hmm. sauce is getting ready and that sort of thing. Yeah.
Was that homemade pasta or was that like store-bought?
It was a combination. So mm-hmm. I had seen, you know, store-bought, but then they also did have a pasta maker. Mm-hmm. So I have seen them, you know, make pasta at times. But the sauce was homemade and the meatballs were homemade. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the thing. My grandmother, she's still around. She's like 97. She's going to be 97. Mm-hmm. my grandfather passed away a long time ago, but he was like the family, like patriarch, you know. Mm-hmm. And when they made the meal, now, granted, they were married for a long, long time at this point when I'm a little kid. And they each had their roles when it mm-hmm. came to the food. Now, the thing is, my grandmother is a vegan. She's mm-hmm. not just a vegetarian, she's a vegan. The only animal byproduct I ever saw her consume was a little bit of mozzarella cheese mm-hmm. on her sauce. That's it. Like, she didn't touch meat. In fact, she was pretty fastidious about even like leather, you know, mm-hmm. clothing that she would wear, shoes that she mm-hmm. would wear. Like, they couldn't be made out of leather. They had to be, you know, synthesized or something like mm-hmm. that. So she was pretty strict about that, but it was because she's an animal lover. Like, she mm-hmm. one time rescued a butterfly. You know what I mean? She would save anything. I watched her nurse like little babies of all different kinds of versions of animals. Like, there was a kind of a zoo growing up. There's always little animals somewhere around. Some injured animal was mm-hmm. always at the house. There was mm-hmm. always like an animal to be rescued. So because she didn't like to work with any kind of meat, that was my grandfather's role. So mm-hmm. my grandfather wasn't necessarily like the cook when it came to like the Sunday meal, mm-hmm. but he was the one that made the meatballs.
Okay.
Now, it'll be interesting to hear what other people say when they hear me say this, but I think that I have grown up with these traditions and these sayings mm-hmm. that I don't know if they're unique to my family, and it could mm-hmm. just be like an Italian phrase. But when we were kids, we would say, "Grandpa, why do you make the meatballs? Why does grandma make the spaghetti and why do you make the meatballs?" And he, you know, as he was rolling it with his hands, he would say, "Because my hands taste better." So I don't know if you've heard that phrase or not, but, you know, so your hands taste good. Like, when mm-hmm. that's a compliment that you mm-hmm. give somebody when you've had some kind of meat or some food that they've prepared with their hands, mm-hmm. you say, "Oh, your hands taste good."
So sounds, I say that to really my husband. Weird.
It does sound really weird, but I'm telling you, this is just like strange phrases that, mm-hmm. that they would say. Mm-hmm. And so those have kind of become traditions or little cute little sayings that now we've incorporated into my family. So my husband is the foodie of this mm-hmm. family, and he's the one that makes all kinds of dishes and stuff. And there's certain things that are our favorites, of course. Mm-hmm. And so for my husband, it's meatloaf or mm-hmm. meatloaf. Mm-hmm. The kids called it, they they heard Meat Love. So that's what we call it now. Meat Love, not meatloaf. It's called Meat Love.
Oh, that's kind of cute.
Yeah. So we say, Daddy makes the meat love and his mm-hmm. hands taste good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, warm it with your hands. So that's one little tradition that's kind of carried
mm-hmm.
over.
Mm-hmm.
Now, another tradition that I remember growing up was, so this is all in like the scope and sequence of things. So, you know, you get there, you smell, you hear the water boiling, you smell the pasta, you mm-hmm. smell the sauce, and you see my grandfather working the meatballs into these, you know, perfect little round mm-hmm. balls. And so you kind of see these like, these roles that they have, these jobs mm-hmm. that they have to mm-hmm. do. And everybody kind of pitches in with like setting the table and things like that. But it's mostly my grandmother and my grandfather that are doing, you know, those kind of mm-hmm. parts. Now, as the water is boiling and the pasta is getting ready, then there's this other little tradition that they do. So I guess my grandfather would like, sometimes he would prepare the meatballs the night before, but other times, depending on the timing of things, he would be, you know, making them mm-hmm. or finishing them up that day. And then they'd be, you know, cooked and stuff, you know, with the sauce.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess all of that stuff was done like prior so that it, you know, had more flavor.
Yeah.
And then the pasta was boiled later, of course.
Yeah.
And so the sauce is getting ready. The meatballs are getting ready
mm-hmm.
and you can smell it like wafting through the mm-hmm. air. And then as the pasta is getting ready, what she would do, and again, this is one of those like tradition things that I don't know if other people do, but it was customary that the first noodle that came out, she would take it into my grandfather and kind of like give it to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd like slurp it mm-hmm. and he'd say, you know, good, like good to go. It mm-hmm. like had to get his blessing, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the noodles are ready. Or pasta's
yeah,
ready.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so as a little kid, I remember thinking like, oh, you know, the pasta's not ready until Grandpop says it's ready. Until Grandmom gives Grandpop the
mm-hmm.
noodle
mm-hmm.
and he says, yeah, that's good. Or says, you know, no, give it 5 more minutes mm-hmm. or, you know, mm-hmm. something like that. Like that never really happened. He never said it needed more time. Like he yeah. never critiqued it or anything.
No.
It was just like a formality, I think.
Mm. Yeah, because, I mean, your grandma probably had been cooking yeah. pasta for like her entire life and she knew right. they were ready.
Exactly. It was like just as a little kid, that didn't click for mm-hmm. me. So as a little mm-hmm. kid, I really, really believe that it was my grandfather saying so. That mm-hmm. it was his say so that once he slurped that noodle, that mm-hmm. it was time, you know. And then putting two and two together as I got older, thinking, yeah, Grandma's probably been doing this for a long time. She probably knows it's ready. Yep. She doesn't need Grandpop to tell her this, and she doesn't need a noodle to tell her nope. to tell her this. But that was the formality. That was the tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like these things that we do that aren't really technically necessary,
mm-hmm.
but I think it is a sign of love. It's a it's some kind of a communication of love
mm-hmm.
between these two people. That even though I know what you're doing, or even though I know you know what I'm doing, I'm still gonna, you know, ask for your opinion. I'm still gonna, you know, give this to you as a sign of my love, as a mm-hmm. token of my appreciation or something. And sometimes what made it extra special was, you know, there were times when, especially sports. So the men in my family watched a lot of sports. My grandfather loved golf. He loved all the different kind of, you know, sports balls.
Mm-hmm.
And times when there were games going on, you know, you had to be kind of careful as to like, just the right kind of timing as to when to present the noodle to him, because mm-hmm. sometimes you get like irritated, like, you know, hurry up, you know, give me the noodle or something. But so there were times when it was like, okay, do you want to go give Grandpop the noodle? And so mm-hmm. sometimes like one of us children would be the delivery,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
we would deliver the noodle to mm-hmm. my grandfather.
<That's
pretty> It's like this kind of trepidatious, like, mm-hmm. should we go in? Okay, let's wait till there's a commercial or, you know, something. My grandfather, God rest his soul, like he, later on in life, like I was very, very, very close with my grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was much younger growing up, like he was kind of really like mean, and he was just like no filter. And like he would tell you what he thought, because that's just how he was. I mean, times were tough. You know, he mm-hmm. grew up like he had a really, really hard life growing up, you know, and he also had a heart condition. So he mm-hmm. had several, you know, heart surgeries and stuff. Mm-hmm. So we all kind of had to walk on eggshells around Grandpa. Mm-hmm. You know, we mm-hmm. always had to keep things quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of like, as an adult, I look back, you know, when I was younger, I used to think, oh God, he's just so grumpy, so nasty all the time. And, you know, we all kind of like feared him.
Mm-hmm.
And then looking back, I realized, oh, well, it's because, you know, he had a heart condition. And I really think that he had, what is it called? There's a condition that people have. Is it dysnomia? Where they can't stand people chewing.
Like they, oh, yeah, yeah.
You know what
yeah,
I mean? Like
yeah,
when people are eating together, there are certain people there's a condition for mm-hmm. it, and it escapes yeah. me right now. I think it starts with a D, or I might be wrong. But anyway, there's a condition where people can't eat with each other because they can't stand the mm-hmm. sound of people's yeah. lips smacking together. Yep. Well, he had whatever that was mm-hmm. because he could not stand it if you chewed gum around him. Like that mm-hmm. would just set him off. Mm-hmm. And so looking back, I think, well, why didn't Grandpa eat at the table with us? He ate at his chair. So A, it was probably a space constraint that mm-hmm. it just made more sense for him to be out there. Because I always kind of felt like, well, gee, like the men are kind of in the living room and mm-hmm. we're kind of out here and mm-hmm. not everybody's eating at the table together, mm-hmm. but yet we were all together. Like mm-hmm. we were all spending time together. Just we weren't eating in the same exact yeah, place, but we were all eating together. Yeah, everybody was having table. A meal together.
Yeah.
But space was at a premium. Mm-hmm. So there was logistics involved. Mm-hmm. I think he had that condition where he couldn't stand mm-hmm. to hear people, you know, mm-hmm. their mouths. So that's why also I remember my grandfather growing up where he'd always have one earbud in his ear. He always had this like pocket radio mm-hmm. and he could have had like ADD maybe. Yeah, I wonder maybe. Because he would watch he would be watching TV and be watching the game, following mm-hmm. the game, but he was also a fire chief for a mm-hmm. while. And so he constantly, that's another thing that I associate with the smell of pasta mm-hmm. is sounds. Like, you know mm-hmm. how you connect sounds mm-hmm. with yeah. and smells?
Yeah.
So for me, if I could paint this picture for you, it would be the sound of a sports game. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the roaring crowd mm-hmm. in the background.
Yeah. So sports announcer talking about what's mm-hmm. going on right now. Yeah.
Especially like golf, you know how they can't really talk quiet uh-huh. and they start uh-huh. to whisper and they start to talk about the game. Like, so have you heard of ASMR?
Yes, I have.
So I experience ASMR. I'm one of those like people who mm-hmm. has that wiring. Mm-hmm. I think it stems from that because mm-hmm. I grew up listening to these sounds that just lulled me to sleep. Mm-hmm. So I'll get to that in a second. So the sounds would be, you know, the sports game in the background, but then also combined with that would be a little bit of radio chatter from the police radio mm-hmm. because he would listen to the fire and police rescue. And so mm-hmm. I grew up with the sound of that constantly as white noise in the background, mm-hmm. you know, just the constant dispatchers, you know, going mm-hmm. on because he listened to that all the time. Mm-hmm. So he would have in one ear, he would be listening to something, whether it was the police dispatcher radio or another game sometimes. Sometimes he would listen to another game. Like he would listen to a baseball game in one ear and watch golf on the TV. Yeah, I mean, the guy was just like, you know, so I can see where I get a lot mm-hmm. of things sometimes.
It's funny how stuff like that influences you, like at a yeah. very like early stage and also like
it's a sensory. Yeah. It's all sensory input yeah. and all these things you experience. Mm-hmm. So those are the sounds involved. And then you've got, you know, the boiling water and then you've got the people, mm-hmm. you know, chattering around eating our food. And then here comes the spoon and the fork thing. So I was talking to my mom. So I told you a little bit of the story, but, you know, for the listeners. Mm-hmm. So I'm 45 now, right? And I did not know for all these years, I only learned this like about a year or two ago, mm-hmm. that all these years, so I was always taught to eat spaghetti with just a fork. Mm-hmm. We never used a spoon. Yep. In fact, like we didn't even have a spoon at the place setting. Like there was no need for a spoon mm-hmm. for anything that had to deal with our spaghetti dinner.
Yeah.
The only time spoons came out was when the tea came out to, you know, we'd have tea and to, mm-hmm. you know, you'd wrap the tea bag around it. Mm-hmm. Use your spoon to dunk it. And so when I got married and moved out here and started, you know, eating meals with my husband, and that was mm-hmm. that's a whole other adventure. But he would like make fun of me. And he mm-hmm. would say, because you know, we go to have pasta together and like sometimes I would prepare it early on in our marriage. I used to try to impress him, you know, make some homemade sauce and stuff. Mm-hmm. And we would eat together and he'd eat with a spoon and a fork and he'd, you know, twirl his spaghetti into the spoon. And he would look at me and say, "Don't you need a spoon? You know, where's your spoon?" And I would say, and this is just like the verb, you know, the phrase that we would say is, "Real Italians don't need a spoon."
Yeah,
that was just like what I was taught to say growing mm-hmm. up. Like if anybody asked, "Real Italians don't need a spoon."
Yeah,
and that's what people would say. And yeah. so I mean, like, there's this progression. Mm-hmm. Like you learn how to eat spaghetti. Like that's a milestone mm-hmm. as a child growing up. So. Yeah. When you're first, you know, little, like some of your first food, they cut it up, you know, mm-hmm. watch, you know, ooh. No spoon involved, but a knife and a fork, you know, cutting mm-hmm. up the spaghetti mm-hmm. and you call them skeddies. Mm-hmm. So at first it was like, you learn to say the word spaghetti, but first it was skeddies. You know, it's like, oh, you finally graduated. You can say spaghetti now. Mm-hmm. You must be like four, you know. And then when you first learned how to twirl it, but we mm-hmm. never ever used a spoon. Like we were mm-hmm. never taught with a spoon. We were taught to, twist the fork. Yeah. And so I used to just kind of put it off. My husband mm-hmm. would kind of tease me for things. That was just kind of the, lovey-dovey stuff of our of our marriage. You just kind of you tease each other about mm-hmm. stuff, right? And I just accepted that as just mm-hmm. him teasing me about stuff. And then finally I got sick of it because then we had kids mm-hmm. and then, started to teach the kids how mm-hmm. to eat and stuff. And my husband didn't really press, I didn't press it. Like if he wanted to teach them how to do a spoon on a fork, mm-hmm. I was all right, whatever. And I didn't really push the issue too much. I just figured I'm going to eat the way that I was taught. Yeah. And if you guys want to do it that way, go for
it. Whatever works.
Yeah. It was just like a personal thing of mine, mm-hmm. I guess. And so finally the kids started asking questions like, Mommy, Daddy, why do you eat your spaghetti so differently? And so finally I was like, I don't know how to answer that. Like, because I was always just taught that real Italians do mm-hmm. it this way. Mm-hmm. And my husband, for whatever reason, thought that this, for whatever reason, he was told that, no, the real Italians are supposed to, this is how it went in Rome, mm-hmm. this is how you do it. Because mm-hmm. I guess, because he's traveled the world and I mm-hmm. haven't. Mm-hmm. So I just assumed that, maybe he was right. And I don't know, for whatever reason, my family did it differently. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
You know what's funny? My dad, my dad taught me the same thing. He has zero Italian ancestry, nothing.
Yeah.
He just loved Italy and loved Italian food. And like I remember as a kid, I started exactly the same way. First the cut up spaghetti. And uh-huh. then at some point, only the fork. Real Italians do it that way.
Yeah.
Exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when the kids asked, then I thought, okay, I got to get to the bottom of this because why is this so different? Mm-hmm. What is causing the difference here? And how do I explain this to my kids? Mm-hmm. So finally I decided to call my mom and I said, Mom, why do we only eat with a fork? Why is it? Because I started seeing it out west. Mm-hmm. Anytime we would go out to eat, any places or eating with other people mm-hmm. and there was some kind of pasta served, whether it was, angel hair, whatever. Mm-hmm. I saw the spoon and the fork come out. I was mm-hmm. like, what is wrong with me? I just thought, I'm from Pennsylvania. I'm from back east. I guess it's just an Eastern thing. Mm-hmm. I just started to accept that. That's a whole other food journey is when you move from one end of the country to the other, mm-hmm. there are things that are really, really different. And you don't know because you live in a bubble all your life. And then you move somewhere and you're like, oh, things are done really differently here. I'm the weirdo.
Yeah.
So I just kind of accepted it that mm-hmm. I was just the weirdo. Mm-hmm. So finally I decided to ask my mom about it. I was like, Ma, why do we eat our spaghetti this way? And then what she told me kind of shocked me in a way. And I actually kind of got sad for a while. I'm better about it now. But at first, I kind of cried and I was upset about it because what she told me was that when my grandfather's family came over, they wanted so badly to assimilate and mm-hmm. they wanted so badly to be American mm-hmm. that my grandfather was very, very strict about assimilating and mm-hmm. about doing everything the American way. Mm-hmm. And so even though we were told, even though the phrase was real Italians don't need a spoon, mm-hmm. for whatever reason, he told the family that was the American way to do it mm-hmm. and that this is how we will eat. Mm-hmm. And now it could be that my mom misunderstands the story. I don't really know because some things were embellished. It's hard to get the story straight. But I think that she thinks that, and what she told me was that my grandfather was strict about assimilation and that he forbade them from, they always wanted to learn Italian and he refused to teach them Italian because he didn't want his children speaking Italian. Mm-hmm. He really kind of rejected, mm-hmm. He was in private, he was proud to be Italian, mm-hmm. but outwardly, it was not something he was mm-hmm. flaunt, I guess. Mm-hmm. The family wouldn't flaunt it. And when I watched that series and from the things that my mom has told me and I connect the dots now, I understand why. Mm-hmm. Because there really was a time, whether it was, his childhood growing up and the way that his family, his parents had to be in order to survive. There was a time when Italians were really discriminated against. Mm-hmm. In fact, I was told stories. And so you see me, I'm very pale, complected. Mm-hmm. But the rest of my family is very dark. mm-hmm. And so they're sun worshipers. My great aunts and uncles are very, very dark skin. And it's mm-hmm. almost it's kind of a joke. They could go out in the sun and they're dark. they tan so quickly. And I always thought, I mean, I grew up in the 80s. And so I actually like injured myself. I actually burnt myself trying to look like my family because tanning was like a big thing back then.
Yeah.
It was pretty terrible. Like I really had to learn my lesson the hard way about that.
No,
I've got the Irish genes. I did not get that part of the Italian genetics, unfortunately. And same with my mother. Like we just burn. But yet my aunts and my uncles, opposite. Just like didn't even look like they were related sometimes because of the difference. But the sad thing that I was told was that my grandmother, when she was dating my grandfather, they called my grandfather the N-word. They were referred to as the N-word back then.
Okay.
Because of their skin complexion and because they came over, they kind of like invaded, they were seen as the enemy, they were discriminated against, you know, they weren't given jobs, that sort of thing. And so I think it was like a survival tactic that
for sure.
They had to survive, they had to assimilate, they had to blend in as best they could so that they could survive. So, you know, I was like upset about it, but then, you know, or the things that like didn't make sense back then, but now knowing a little bit more of the history, I look back and I think, oh, okay, that makes sense now.
Yeah.
Doesn't make it okay by any stretch of the imagination, but like it makes more sense as to why people did things a certain way. Like they just either didn't know better or, you know, things were just a very, very different time back there. So, so that was interesting to learn that the reason, like the whole reason why we eat our spaghetti differently than what you see with the spoon and the fork is because they wanted to assimilate that this is the way that the Americans were doing it. And so they wanted to look American. Like she said, my grandfather didn't want his children to like basically be caught being Italian. Like he didn't want them to be looked at as foreigners. So they had to do it the American way. So that made me kind of sad because, and then along with that story, I found out that, oh my gosh, like here, you know, like I'm not going to reveal people's identities or anything, but like the names of my family members have been changed. Like that's not, growing up all my life, I knew them as like so-and-so and so-and-so, but that actually wasn't their name. Their name was actually changed. And I just thought, you know, okay, the last name got changed. Yeah, anybody with that had a vowel, you know, a last name that ends in a vowel. I just always thought, oh, you know, when they came through Ellis Island, it got, you know, misspelled or you couldn't read the handwriting or something like that. I knew that there was some of that going on. But what I didn't know is that some of the children were orphaned or put into like a foster care situation. And the schools actually changed their names because they were too difficult to pronounce. Again, like just assimilating into that Americana.
Or people just changed them themselves simply to, like, as you said, not to fit in and not be like the foreigner all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that happens
a lot.
So that's
what made me sad because people not only gave up the way that they eat food, but they gave up their original names, like their identities. Just to fit in. And I just kind of feel like you shouldn't have to do that. But that's what they had to do to survive back then. And it's still happening, sadly, because even just as close, you know, it was just a short time ago within the last, you know, decade and a half or so, when I was working as a computer site tech, one of my jobs to do, I worked at an elementary school, and one of my jobs was data entry, you know, one of many jobs. I had to create the accounts on the server for the children to log into. And it was always difficult when it came to the Asian American children because I would, you know, be typing up their name. And of course, you know, it was difficult because you're, you know, combining these letters that I've never seen combinations of this before. I had to actually like tape it out and look at it like three times to make sure that I spelled it correctly. But you're given their, you know, their birth name to put into the file. But then they all have an American name. So,
very
you know,
common.
An unpronounceable Chinese name is Jessica or Jennifer or John, you know, and it just like connecting that to my Italian heritage where they had to change their names. It just kind of made me sad that that had to take place all in the name of, you know, being able to survive here. So that was an interesting story that I learned about why we eat our food the way we eat our food and the types of food that we eat and why it's cooked the way that it's cooked and why, in what order and what sequence and that sort of thing. The pasta was so that they could afford, you know, to feed their families because it's stretched so far.
I mean, that's the whole reason like why pasta I think exists, because it was like fairly cheap to make, fairly like you could combine it with almost anything and like it would work. Did you ever like cook with your family or with your grandma, or was that more like she was cooking with your grandpa and that was it?
That's a good question. And that's what kind of forms my relationship with cooking food, unfortunately. So I didn't get to do a lot of cooking growing up or baking necessarily, at least not when I was like still living at home with my family. My family divorced when I was 12, so things got all mixed up and changed after that. But up until that time, children were kind of like supposed to be just kind of shushed, you know, shushed away. It was like, it was up to the adults. We were brought in, you know, as we got older to help with the dishes and to help with the cleanup. And, you know, we had chores and things like that. But meal prep was not really, we were not involved in that. And I'm disappointed by that. Like, I wished things would have been differently. I would have liked to have grown up with more experience cooking because then what that did is it kind of, it shaped me in a way by which I guess I was kind of enabled because then as I dated, the people I chose to be in relationships with, they had a cook.
It's like one of two has to be able to cook and it's not me. Right. So.
And it, you know, it's always like, oh, you can make this dish and you can make that dish. And you know, I don't know. Part of it was either I was not allowed to be in the kitchen growing up because that wasn't a child's place to be in our family, at least. And then like, as I dated and was in relationships, it was like very kind of clear that I just, not that I'm a bad cook, that I just lacked the experience.
Yeah, you weren't comfortable in the kitchen probably, like, because it's never a place that you like existed or had like spent time.
Yeah. Like anytime I wanted to go in the kitchen, it was, you know, we get yelled at, like, get out of here, you know, go play, go do something else. You know, it was just always kind of, we were always kind of shushed and scolded away. So that didn't give me a very good experience. And then as I started to try to learn how to do things on my own, like, of course, I, you know, I learned how to cook. I can feed myself and I can cook for my family if I have to. But if I don't have to, then why bother? So I would say that I am an enabled person when it comes to that. So why I say I'm not necessarily a foodie. There have been times in my life where I have enjoyed cooking. I've never been much of a baker at all, except for, and this is another foodie memory that I will share. There was a time where I did start to get kind of creative. So I told you about my relationship with food when it comes to my mother's side of things. Now I want to tell you about my father's side of things, because like I said, you know, we were a family unit, but after 12, things kind of like started to fall apart. And so around the age like 10 or so, my dad was in the Navy, so he has, you know, certain ways of doing things. And there were certain, I wouldn't say it was like a cook or anything. My mom, you know, kind of traditional gender role household growing up. My dad, you know, worked. My mom did like part-time jobs and freelance, kind of like I do. And she would prepare the meals. And then when my baby brother was born, he was born via cesarean section. So my mother had to be in the hospital for like a couple of days. And it was that time when my sister and I experienced my father's cooking, using air quotes. My dad's style of cooking is like survival kind of like, it's a little militaristic, I guess I would say, because, you know, he's used to being kind of cooked for, but yet he's creative. Like he can come up with some things, but it's like your basic like meat and potatoes, you know, very German and very starchy and
very
and
militaristic.
The things that he would make. And so when my mom was in the hospital, my dad had to like, you know, make meals for us. And it consisted of like, we ate a lot of like TV dinners, lots of TV tray stuff, but he would make, have you ever had corn, cream beef? So I can't say what it is. It's HIT on a shingle.
Actually, I think Doc mentioned that as well. Like, because he has also a military. He has a military background, and like he was like, "Oh yeah, that's like."
I'll have to listen to that. I have to ask him about that sometime. But that's what my dad. We ate that for like days.
SOS.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is. It's SOS. And so, like, I remember, like, he'd boil it, and he was really into like the minute rice bags. And, you know, so we, and like when my family divorced, so like first when my brother was born, like we survived on that kind of stuff. So he would make it and he would put it like over toast, you know, that was a meal for us. And we were little, so, you know, we dealt with it.
And it was probably exciting. I mean, did your mom do TV dinners a lot, or was that like more your dad?
It did. It did, like, after my brother came, because he was colicky and they were, like, exhausted, and, like, at the time.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I just tried to, like, entertain him. But, like, now, as an adult with kids, I get it. I'm so sorry, mom and dad. I'm so sorry.
but I mean, when your dad, like, when your dad was doing it, it was, like a special thing, kind of.
Right? It was novel. It was novel.
Yeah. So you were fine. You were fine. It was like, oh, that's fine. Yeah.
It was like survival, but it was fine. You know, like, this is how we have to do it. And it's not going to be forever, but it lasted for quite a while. And then when my brother came along and he was colicky and they were exhausted. So the TV dinners kind of became like a Friday thing. And but we as kids, we thought it was awesome because we got to eat on like our Pac-Man TV trays out in the living room. Yeah. And so they made it special. Yes. Yeah. So fun food.
Fun food.
So that was like during the week. And then we always had like our go-to Sunday spaghetti. Mm-hmm. So for me, spaghetti is comfort food. Mm-hmm. That is my number one comfort food that, like, I feel like in an apocalypse like this, I could eat spaghetti every day and I'd be fine. Mm-hmm. Now, here's where the problem comes in, though. After I had my second son, I was, you know, dealing with a lot of, you know, issues and stuff. Mm-hmm. I had been dealing with issues with my first son, you know, 3 or 4 years prior. And I started going through lots of testing, like, what is wrong with me? What is causing all this pain? What is causing all this lethargy? Like, I'd had some procedures, like I had my deviated septum fixed and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was just like all of this stuff that, you know, I was going through. Mm-hmm. And come to find out, after years and years and years of testing, I finally got a diagnosis of fibromyalgia. Mm-hmm. And, you know, later on, you know, there's other exacerbations after that. But so let me back up just a little bit. So I probably had fibromyalgia for a long, long time before then. Like, if I think back, like, oh, yeah, it makes sense. You know, I just didn't know.
Yeah, one of the things, like, whereas, like, everything, like, you get that, get that diagnosis and you're like, oh, that makes sense.
That makes sense. Exactly. Exactly. So I probably had it for a long, long time before then. But prior to that, what I experienced was, and this is all has to do with like food and like how things change and comfort food. Because I listened to most of the episode where you were talking with Ewan, and he shared what it was like when he got his diabetes diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So I had a similar experience when I was pregnant with my first son. I had gestational diabetes, and that's the kind of diabetes, for people don't know, basically it goes away after you've had the child,
but it can come
back. And it did, like, it came back with my second pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And it also puts you like in a higher risk bracket later. Mm-hmm. So now I'm like pre-diabetic.
Yep.
So I don't have diabetes yet, but if I don't take medication, I will end up with it. So I have to be really careful. And because of the fibro and because of the, you know, other issues that I have with my joints and my muscles and things, it's really difficult for me to lose weight. It's really easy for me to gain weight just because of my age, but it's really difficult to keep the weight off because I can't exercise like I would like to. I injure myself really easily. Mm-hmm. You know, I would love to work out. I love being active. It's hard for me to sit down. Like, I'm actually always on the move because it hurts to, like, I'm distracted right now, but like, it hurts to sit for a while. It hurts to sleep, you know, that kind of stuff. But actual exercise, cardio, aerobics, like, disciplined, you know, strength training, that's like, yeah, that's really difficult for me to do. So I had to control it with diet. And when I was pregnant the first time, and this was before, you know, so like I wasn't like obese. Like, I wasn't at an unhealthy, you know, I was overweight, but like I wasn't like I am now. But back then, you know, it's manageable. And so when I got pregnant, I was very active. I was, you know, working in elementary school where I walked all the time. Mm-hmm. And I went and did, there's this part in your pregnancy where I guess it's like towards the like middle to end, they have you drink this like really sugary drink. It's a glucose test.
Yeah, it's a glucose test.
And I failed it. I failed it with flying colors. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh man, that's such a bummer. Like, you really just hoped you didn't have that. Mm-hmm. And so they told me like I had to be really good or else I was going to have to like get injections and all that kind of stuff. So I did. I was very, very good. And I remember when Ewan was talking about it and he was talking about like how much fat he had to consume.
Yeah.
That was my like, oh my God, I can't believe how much fat. Like, I went to see a dietitian too. You know, that was like, you're prescribed, you know, you got to go see a dietitian. I had to prick my finger like four times a day and all that kind of stuff and track my blood. And it was like, wow, it was a lot of work. And it was really hard because when you're pregnant, and you're told like all your life, like the model that's set for you is that you eat for two.
Yeah.
And that you're supposed to eat whatever you want. And yeah. you're, you know, people like offer you food. Like when you're pregnant, when people know you're pregnant, they just shove food at you all the time.
And I mean, the Italian background as well. I mean, one, it's a lot of
carbs
everywhere, basically, like whether it's bread, whether it's pasta, like it's just everywhere.
And also
the culture of eating, like I mean, mm-hmm. like the it's basically like the grandma is shoving food in. I mean, I know from friends of mine.
Yeah, manja.
Yeah, exactly. It's a stereotype, but it's true. Like, I mean, I've experienced it in Italy, like with my friends. Like, it is true. So
yeah, you're in fact, like I, even though I know it's like it is a true stereotype, like it's still a stereotype. But even I like do it because I'm kind of programmed that way. If you come to my house and I just want to feed you. Like that's our love language. I just want to feed you.
Absolutely.
Whether it's crackers or something. And like if you don't eat it, I'm kind of offended.
No, I do that too.
But that's like, just how I was raised. You know, like you've got to eat. Yeah. Or the other thing is like the weight. Mm-hmm. So Italians are pretty round, you know, like we're fat and happy. Yep. You know. We all have like these big, huge arms. You're like back in Pennsylvania, like you can just tell like that's the whole like Italian German sector there. It's like you can tell by looking at our arms. You can just tell.
Okay.
We're just big, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can't push us over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I mean, that makes it difficult.
If you're skinny, like, you cannot be a skinny Italian. No. That's like against the law.
Something is wrong with you.
And if you date a skinny man or you date a skinny woman, like there's something wrong with them and they need to be fattened up.
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of the culture too. So yes, like so much food. And so now luckily for me, because things could have gone really, really poorly had this happened when I was still living in Pennsylvania. But luckily for me, I was living out west.
Mm-hmm.
So I could control things just a little bit better. And so here I am pregnant with my first child. And I come from this background where the women just like gain, you know, I mean, and we're all short too, by the way. So when women are pregnant and they're Italian, they're kind of like as round as they are tall. So I grew up with this notion that you must be round, that you must have this big round beach ball of a pregnant baby bump. And, you know, I watched, like my mother was, I was 10 when my brother was born. I was 15 when my second brother was born. So like, I've seen my mother pregnant, you know, and I've seen my aunts pregnant. And I've seen my cousins pregnant. Like I have a lot of cousins. I've seen a lot of pregnant women in that, in my family on both sides. And they were all very, very round and they all gained a lot of weight. And we, you know, come from a breastfeeding culture. So we breastfed and that's like the best diet in the world. You will lose weight and then some. And I did. But so my first pregnancy, I didn't gain a lot of weight. Like I was proud of that. I was really kind of proud of that. But I also, it was a little depressing in a way because I couldn't enjoy it.
Yeah.
I couldn't enjoy the food.
Yeah.
I couldn't enjoy, like when you're pregnant, you get so excited. You're like, oh my God, I get to eat like a Snickers and like two, I can eat anything I want. And people will just give you food. But now like I had to like turn it down and I had to like, you know, tell people no. And that was really hard to do. And I couldn't eat the things I wanted to eat. And here I am on this really super restrictive diet, but yet it was restrictive, but yet it was different because I couldn't believe, and again, coming from the culture of that fat is so bad for you, fat is bad.
Yeah.
Fat is bad. And when you're diabetic, sugar is bad, depending on your levels. So like Splenda was in everything. Of course, now we know that that's not good for you either. But back then, like, you know, that was like, okay, let's look for all the Splenda labels. So I had to look for all the Splenda labels. I had to watch my sugar. I had to watch everything I ate. And I had to consume so much fat. And I just felt weird about it. Like it did not feel right. But, you know, looking at the scale, looking at the numbers, that was the confirmation that it was the right thing to do. Yeah. Like it's, you know, you prick your finger, you check your blood. It tells you that, yes, you've, you know, like if I had a piece of bread or if I had some cereal, my numbers were bad and I could feel it. Like I could feel it too. Like I felt, you know, diabetic. It was really rough. So here I was like, I only gained like 20 some pounds. It was like, I think
not much.
It was like 20, 22, 26 pounds or something like that, which I mean, that's like a quarter of what the other women in my family gained. And my sister was pregnant at the time. And back then we had like iChat, you know, we would FaceTime.
Ooh,
it was iChat back then. And every couple of weeks, like we would get together and we would stand up and we would compare bellies. And I just remember thinking like this mixed emotions of like, oh, I wish I could have a big belly like that. Like, I had belly and I had bump envy. I seriously had bump envy. Funny. It is. It's funny and it's like confusing it's and it's sad. Like sad all at once. Because like you're supposed to, like, the bump is like so celebrated. And here I was like, I'd stand up and I would just have this kind of like flat, like, I just looked fat. I didn't look pregnant. I looked fat. And it just upset me so much. I still had a waistline. Throughout my whole pregnancy, I had a waistline. Like, that's not supposed to happen. That just doesn't look right. Like, even my coworkers were like, are you okay?
Are you,
like,
really, you're not pregnant?
I mean, because it was my first child, and, like, you don't show a lot the first time anyway. And so that I had that going for me. But, and plus, I was walking everywhere. I wish I had a Fitbit back then. Man, I would have had a lot of stuff. So the diet thing was, like, that was really, really rough. That was really, really rough, trying to be pregnant and, like, deal with all that stuff. And then, interestingly, so then, you know, when I had the baby and then I was breastfeeding, then that's when I could eat anything. That's when I felt like that was, like, the best diet in the world. And here's the funny thing. Like, that's when people offer you lots of beer. There's this, have you heard this? There's this belief that, there's this belief that if you drink beer while you're breastfeeding, it's supposed to, like, make your milk better, fuller, come in better, or something like that. Yeah,
must be a Bavarian thing.
Yeah, I'm telling you, it was like, that was not the Italian thing. That must have been like the German thing, but it was like old wives' tales.
That must be a Bavarian thing. Like, get some
it's
beer
an excuse
to the kid,
to drink beer.
Exactly.
It's an excuse to drink beer.
The kid needs some beer.
Yeah. I mean, you're really, 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 really thirsty when you're breastfeeding anyway. So, like, you constantly wanted to drink stuff. And so people were like, here's a beer. You know, like, this is probably not good, but okay. You're not going to turn it down. So, yeah, so that was interesting. So, so I had another story that I was going to tell you
I wanted to ask you about comfort food and the quarantine. Like, you mentioned that, like, in the pre-show, you mentioned it in passing a little bit, but I think that's really fascinating. Like, how people crave comfort food right now. And also, I think how the quarantine is, to some extent, influencing us there.
Well, that's what I was going to talk about. So let me just back up a little bit. That's why I brought up the pregnancy and I brought up the whole Italian heritage, because being pregnant while being raised Italian was difficult, and having diabetes was really difficult. And then after I got my fibromyalgia diagnosis and I was struggling with inflammation issues, I had to change my diet drastically. So the diabetes diet was one thing where I had to consume all the fat and lower the carbs. But I learned from that's what helped with controlling inflammation. So getting the carbs down and then cutting out things like gluten and cutting out things like milk and dairy products. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about that. So I actually, and it's fine, like, you guys talk about bacon and meats and everything. It's fine. I'm not offended or anything. But I have developed a personal feeling about it since I breastfed my children. There's just something about feeding your own babies that way that, you look at other mammals that feed, they're young that way. Like, you look at cats and you look at pigs and you look at, you know, dogs, and you can't look at them the same ever again.
Okay.
And then when it comes to cows, like, you watch cows being milked, and, like, I had to express my milk for a while because I had problems and I went back to work. It's like, I know what it's like to be milked, and I didn't like it. So I can't stand the fact that cows are being exploited for it. So, I cut out dairy for dietary reasons, but also for conscientious reasons. And I decided, and I don't necessarily impose it on my family, but it's my own personal choice, that I've decided that I don't want to consume meat that comes from an animal that nurses or gives birth to live young. So I've basically reduced it to fish and chicken and poultry, that sort of thing. So occasionally I'll eat beef, but it's not something that I eat on a regular basis. So that's what's so the pregnancy, the diabetes, the fibro, the inflammation, like, all of those different health changes is what has changed my diet. And then it's also impacted my comfort food. So the very first thing that I had to find a substitution for comfort food was pasta.
Yeah.
That was like, I could not live without pasta. So we switched to quinoa. And everything's good. We tried rice. We tried a couple of other different types of formulations, but the one that seems to work the best is quinoa. So that's been interesting in my relationship with my husband, is, like, he's still like trying to catch on, but he's doing a great job. It's challenging because he's the foodie and he loves recipes.
Yeah. And I mean, he also has that German background a little bit, which is like makes it very difficult.
So he's actually Scottish Welsh, but he lived in Germany for a number of years.
Somehow.
Yeah. Well, he speaks German. He's lived in Germany. He loves German food. But he loves all different kinds of cultures. And that's the thing. Like, he's the creative one. Mm-hmm. He's the one that's so good with timing. He's the one that can apply heat to things and not set off the smoke alarm like I do. Like, when I cook, the smoke alarm comes down. You know? Because I burn things.
I'm going to skip that for now.
So he's the one that's creative. And so I kind of had to task him with like, okay, look, I know that we can't have these dishes anymore. We can't have this recipe anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, I gained so much weight after my second child because my husband's love language is food. Mm-hmm. I'm just very loved, because he just loves making food. He loves feeding people. Like, you'd think he was the Italian. So it's been difficult for him to try to adjust, you know, that level of comfort food. Mm-hmm. So I've had to find substitutions, and then he's kind of filling in with being creative and trying to find substitutions too, like, you know, trying to bake things. Mm-hmm. And baking, that was the other thing I wanted to tell you. So I started to tell you a little bit about my dad and my relationship with my dad and food, and how, you know, he's kind of militaristic and kind of survival stuff. And he's lots and lots of potatoes. He puts potatoes in everything, which I love potatoes, so I'm not going to complain. But there was a time when I did start to stretch my legs a little bit, and I tried baking. Mm-hmm. And back east, we have apple dumplings and apple crisp. Like, those are two common dishes.
Yep.
And did you ever have this happen where, like, in your family, there's a common dish and one side of the family makes it and the other side of the family makes it, but they kind of make it differently, but it's still just really, really good?
Yeah.
Well, apple crisp is that thing. Mm-hmm. So my Nana has her recipe and my grandmom has her recipe. So the different maternal and paternal grandmothers, but they're both equally good. Like, I could not tell you one is better than the other. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I have that with potato salad. Like, both my grandmas used to make potato salad completely different. Like, I mean, there were potatoes involved, but like,
that's basically the common thing. Apples is the common thing.
That's basically it. And exactly. And I couldn't choose between them. They were both good.
Totally. I wonder how many dishes there are. That would be an interesting survey to conduct. Mm-hmm. How many dishes are there in families? Like, that could be a question that you could ask people. Like, what is one food that both of your grandmothers or grandfathers on either side made that you can't decide between the two, that they're both equally as good? So when it comes to that, it's apple crisp. And if you're familiar with what apple crisp is, there's either the crusty kind or it's kind of soft and mushy. Mm-hmm. Well, my Nana made it a certain way. And my dad and I, so after my parents divorced and I lived with my dad for quite a while, and my dad and I would kind of like, we would cook for each other. We were kind of like surviving, you know, trying to make ends meet. And we lived in this like tiny little studio apartment for a little while. And so we ate a lot of like canned goods and things like that. But then once we moved into a home together, we started to get a little bit more sophisticated and we could afford, you know, a little bit more, you know, better foods and things. And so we started baking together and we decided to have a bake-off. It just kind of happened one time. And so this is one like memory I have with food and with me actually baking the food with my dad is that, see, like I told you when you asked me, you know, kind of exposure I had when I was a child, and I was always shushed out of the kitchen. Mm-hmm. When it came to my dad, like, my dad gave me all the freedom. You know, once I was a teenager, once I was able to live with my dad, then like I had to cook for myself. So I had to learn how to do it. And it was a matter of like, you know, learning, you know, baptism by fire, learning by failure, how to make things. And my eldest son is going through that right now. And it's really kind of fun to watch. Like, he's baking things. Like, the other day, he made brownies or something. He's doubled the amount of water. And he's like, oh, no. Like, it's going to be fine. It's brownies. We'll eat it. And so anyways, so my dad and I decided to have this bake-off. Like, he had made it. And then I wanted to learn how to make apple crisp. So I asked my Nana for her recipe. I asked my grandmother, but my Nana was like a little bit more forthcoming about it. Because like I said, the mother side of the family kind of shush, you know, get out of the kitchen. Whereas my Nana was like, okay, you know, here it is on an index card or whatever. So I got the recipe and my dad had been making it. And so I made it one time for him, and like, he had made some and I said, I'm going to make this. He was like, all right, go ahead. And I made it and it turned out great. and he ate it. And as he was eating it, my dad is like probably the one person that can simultaneously insult me and compliment me at the same time. You know what he said to me? He said, "This is really good. You had Nana go, you went down and got this from Nana. You had her make it and then you brought it here." And it's like, "No, Dad, I made it myself. I baked it myself, you know, because I had like cleaned up the dishes. I guess I got rid of the evidence that I shouldn't have." But he thought that I actually had my Nana make it for me. Like, he thought I was lying about it. Like, how are you supposed to feel about that? Like, I'm insulted and also complimented at the same time that he thinks it's that good.
That's so funny.
So that's one of my my baking memories. And, you know, it's like that one acid trip that I had. Like, it was really good, so I don't want to repeat it. So I'm just not going to bake anymore. So that's kind of how I look at it.
Okay.
So that's my experience with baking, and I'll leave it at that.
So it's one
baking time. Food, I mean. So I had to, so there's that kind of comfort food. So I can't have that kind of comfort food anymore because, of course, it's full of gluten. So I've had to learn other ways to get around that. One time I was on a Weight Watchers diet with a company that I worked at. And because I couldn't have apple crisp anymore, I had to find some kind of way to cheat. So here's this is one recipe that I would give you. It's totally silly and it's totally awful. But this is like cheating, like you can't have a lot of carbs. You can't, this is the Weight Watchers version of apple crisp. Basically what I would do is I would get a bowl and I would put some applesauce in it. And then I would get some graham crackers because like you can count the points on those. And I would put a layer of graham cracker, then applesauce, a little bit of cinnamon, then a layer of graham cracker, then applesauce, a little bit of cinnamon. And then just kind of like stick that in the fridge. And it was like no bake apple crisp, like cheating version.
Yeah.
Like poor man's apple crisp or something like that.
It's simple enough.
And it was enough of the cinnamon and the apple and the graham cracker that just like that combination, like it kind of sort of resembled it. That was my comfort food when I was on on that diet.
Sounds a little bit like an apple, the combination between like an apple crisp and like a tiramisu kind of.
Oh, yeah, I guess you could, yeah, when it got soggy enough, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's like,
work. So now on to quarantine comfort food. So that could be, that could be, if you have that left in your cupboard, you could make quarantine apple crisp, I think.
Yeah.
I think that's what we could call it.
Yep.
So the comment that the point that I brought up earlier when we were talking pre-show was the fact that these are my memories that I just shared of you as I was a kid growing up, and you know, what we did to get through hard times like divorce, you know, and things like that. And now, you know, we're dealing with quarantine. And like I was telling you earlier, shopping, grocery shopping is really, really difficult for a lot of people right now because they either can't get out to the store or, you know, like we're high risk, you know, I'm high risk in my family. And my husband, like he loves to shop. Like that is his like meditation zone. He loves to shop and he does all the grocery shopping. Like he's the one that does it. So when in times past when I've had to do the grocery shopping, it's like, oh my God, I have to sit there texting him the whole time. Like, is it this brand? Is it this one? I was at the grocery store, like, you know, like 2 months ago and I was getting things and some lady saw me taking pictures and she goes, oh, you do that too. Now I don't feel so bad. I'm like, yeah, my husband's a cook. She goes, too. Me too.
I do that too.
Oh, that's how we grocery shop, or at least that's how we used to grocery shop. Now we have to sit there and like fill a digital cart and like queue it up and wait and like try to like get the process to go through.
Well, one advantage is you don't have to text them anymore. It's just like, it's just a website.
You know what though? I was thinking that, but except you would think that that would be better, except no. We had to sit on the couch next to each other and like kind of argue over like what we needed and what quantities we needed. So no, it was actually worse because then we had to sit next to each other. We couldn't get the hell away from each other. We still had our damn phones in our hands because we have like the shopping cart on the website or the app, which was failing. And then we have like we use Grocery Gadget app for shopping. So we had that. So I was like, okay. If I've got it in the cart, you check it off on the list. So like we were like dueling phones here. So I mean, it took like hours. It was exhausting like, just to put the food together. I mean, you would think it's so simple, such a simple thing, but it's not.
No, it's not, because in the store you just walk around and you see stuff and you're like, oh, we need this, we need that. But like at home, you have to think about it. Like you can't just
you have to think about it. And And now with the quarantine, so now you have to like plan far in advance because you want to try to minimize the times that you have to leave the house. I mean, luckily we have curbside pickup here, which I'm really grateful for. But sometimes, you know, you still got to get out of the house. There's still that chance of exposure. And so we try to minimize that. So you're like, okay, well, we were going to get one box, but we really should get two. Like we're not necessarily panic buying because I think that that's different.
Yeah.
But we are definitely, you know, family planning kind of buy, you know, for what we're going to need. And then like, we have two boys, like we have a teenager who's bigger than me. You know what I mean? It's like we had to start using the second fridge. You know? It's like, I mean, we're not going to starve, but like, it's really kind of stressful because like you look at the shelves, like they're getting bare. And we're starting to eye up the things in the cupboard that we don't normally eat, but like they're there and oh, do I really want to have to eat soup for the next week? And so it goes back to those memories that I started out with where, you know, hearing those stories from my grandmother about making pretzel soup, about Italians like scraping the plaster off the wall to make the flour. Like I'm starting to, you know, as we're in quarantine, I'm starting to look at our food supply and I'm starting to have to think creative. Like what can, you know, I was going to throw out some ends of the bread last week and I was like, no, we could, you could use these for breadcrumbs. You know, like I'm starting, it's starting to like kick in all those stories that my elders told us about the ways that they made scraps. And like my dad will tell me stories about things he's put together. Like he'll just, he's one of those guys that like, when I go to visit, I have to like purge the fridge of things that were in there for like that expired 7 years ago, you know, but see, that's what they do. They don't throw anything out. And now it's like really becoming clear why that is. Like I used to look at the expiration date and think, all right, we'll stretch a little bit. All right. Now it's like, it still smells okay.
It looks good. It smells good. It's fine.
You're really starting to think about that kind of stuff. It's awesome. And so,
It's also very interesting. I mean, I come from like a different perspective because I come more from like a, I want to almost say like a restaurant side where you don't throw stuff away either because like that is money that you're throwing away.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people are doing that like now as well, where it's like, okay, I mean, as you said, like the, it in your case, it might be, well, you don't want to go out shopping, but it's also probably a little bit, okay, I don't want to spend the money. And if I can if I can cook something with the leftover, like with the ends from the bread or with whatever leftover, like stuff you cut off, vegetables that you, stuff you cut off, there you can actually make something out of it. And as I said,
like I'm going to eat that whole apple, that whole strawberry. I'm not going to throw, might throw a leaf away. You know?
But it's like in a restaurant, in a restaurant, like, I mean, like the vegetable, like the ends of vegetables and whatever, and the peels or whatever, as long as it's edible somehow and they can make something out of it, they're going to do that. Like, I mean, a lot goes into like the vegetable stock or the whatever stock they make. That's a lot like where they reuse a lot of like stuff that other people would throw away and like extract as much money and food and like dishes out of that as they can because it's in this case literally their business and their money that they're throwing away.
It's going to be a shift.
Yeah.
It's going to be a shift for a lot of people. Well, see, and you were like born in America where in America, like we waste so much. I mean, everybody's guilty of it here. And it's really, really sad. I mean, we were taught to like, it's interesting. There was a shift. We were taught like, don't waste any food. You know, like, growing up, like there's children that are starving and so you can give them.
But it was more about eating the food, not about throwing it away later.
Yeah, I think there was a shift where we were always taught like finish your plate, eat all your food, and then like don't let any food go to waste. And so then if kids did leave their food on their plate, then the parents would eat it. And so I think as a result, for whatever reason combined with that, we all became very obese because we did not control portions. I think that's what I learned the hard way through my dietary changes and things.
Me too.
And what I'm trying to teach the kids is portion control. I mean, we've always done it, but now more so than ever, it is so important for portion control. And I think it just got way out of control. I don't know what happened. Maybe it was just advertising greed or whatever, but the portion controls were so large that people are just like, you know, like the Italians, like mangia mangia, just pile mm-hmm. it on your plate, and mm-hmm. you'd see people eat such large portions of food, mm-hmm. and then you just kind of carried that forward, and then mm-hmm. it was like, okay, well, don't waste any of that mm-hmm. food. Mm-hmm. Never mind that I, the adult, piled it onto your plate, and now I'm going to make you eat it, mm-hmm. and as a result, I'm going to make you feel guilty for not eating it.
Exactly.
And so then we developed all these complexes, and mm-hmm. so we would just eat and eat and eat and eat, mm-hmm. and then everybody just became so obese.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was this shift. That's what I meant to mention, is that then there was this shift that said, you know what? Stop doing that. Mm-hmm. Stop eating everything on your plate. Yeah. If you're full,
you're full.
Be done, and like back away from the table. Yeah. But they didn't say, what they didn't emphasize with the portion control. Mm-hmm. Don't put so much food on your plate to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
But see, Americans, like, they skip over that stuff. They just pile it on and pile mm-hmm. it on. So mm-hmm. The portion sizes are still out of control, mm-hmm. but people are stepping away so that they don't eat so much mm-hmm. when they really should have just fixed the portion size to mm-hmm. begin with.
Yeah.
And so now we just have so much waste. And as mm-hmm. a result of these out of control portion sizes, we have so many food producing places, like mm-hmm. food producing plants and all this agriculture. Mm-hmm. It's just out of control. Like mm-hmm. we have way more food than we actually need.
Yep.
But yet now people are going to go hungry, and you can't buy things that, mm-hmm. you know, are normally your staples and your comfort food mm-hmm. because the supply chain has been disrupted.
Yeah, so it's either the supply chain or also people simply, I mean, they're also like, it's their comfort food. So they're buying it, like, whether they need mm-hmm. it or not, or whether it's like really necessary.
Whether they need it or not.
Yeah, yep, they're
because
buying
it's programming.
Yeah.
We have to have these things because mm-hmm. these are our comfort food. Mm-hmm. So that's why I said to you, it's going to be very interesting to see mm-hmm. how this shakes out
mm-hmm.
because, like, people like us, like, we're frugal, you know, we will survive, like, we will deal, because both my husband and I, especially, mm-hmm. like I said, I've been raised through adversity, through divorce, mm-hmm. through having to survive, you know, having the stories passed down from my mm-hmm. ancestors of mm-hmm. how to survive famines and discrimination and mm-hmm. all this kind of stuff. And so I'm not going to say, like, I have the skills necessary, but I have a little bit of background mm-hmm. that maybe, like, say my kids or maybe people in their 20s and 30s might not have.
Yeah. I mean, you also have the cooking skills and also the adaption skills. Mm-hmm. I mean, you mentioned, like, you had to adapt to also, like, health issues that came up over time mm-hmm. or, like, choices sometimes you also made that, like, that shows adaptability and mm-hmm. fosters a bit adaptability. And that is, like, in a situation right now. And I think if anybody listens to this in, like, whatever, 5 years, they're going to think, oh, it's crazy. But right now we're in the middle of this. And, like,
we're in the middle of this.
Yeah.
And you can start to see how we ended up in some of the situations, like, for mm-hmm. example, with all the carbs and all mm-hmm. the cereals.
Mm-hmm.
So much cereal, so much milk, so many carbs that we are now trying to cut out. Mm-hmm. Now we're looking at supply chain issues, and we're looking at how are we going to make our food stretch. And mm-hmm. I wonder if we're going to end up being forced to, like, revert back to all these carbs just because mm-hmm. it's cheap, just because, mm-hmm. you know, this
cheap
might be,
available.
This is what's cheap and available. Mm-hmm. And this is what we have to make mm-hmm. to feed the family so that we can survive. Mm-hmm. And our blood sugars are going to go, you know, wacko.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's going to be difficult. Like, I'm starting to look at, like, well, you know, we have land and we have soil. We can start, like, growing things. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we're going to have to probably eat bugs.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, bugs
but
are,
I mean, you're starting to
yummy.
Think about, yeah.
Yeah, I've
starting to think about these survival skills mm-hmm. and, you know, things that you're going to have to start mm-hmm. doing. And so mm-hmm. that's why I wonder, how is this going to affect our kids? Mm-hmm. Like, how is it going to form them? How is it going to shape their attitudes when it comes to food?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know how long it will last. I mean, it might last a couple more months. It might last a year, you mm-hmm. know, till
year, 2 years.
Really,
we don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, we just don't know. I mean, the virus is what's going to decide. Mm-hmm. The science is what's going to decide, mm-hmm. you know, how we get back to where we were. And I don't even know that we necessarily really want to go back to a lot of things.
Yeah, I think I agree with you on that. Like, I think, and it's not just about that we don't want to go back. I don't think we can in a lot of situations.
Yeah.
Like, it changes. Yeah. It does change. You and it does change, like, society.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going
to
see.
And it's going to be interesting to see how the kids come out
mm-hmm.
and what kinds of foods are they going to, you know, are we going to revert back to carbs and pasta mm-hmm. because it's affordable? Are they going to grow up with diabetes? Or, you know, what is going to happen? Mm-hmm. What kind of comfort foods are the kids, whether they're healthy or not? But what kind of comfort foods? Like I said, you know, I grew mm-hmm. up with a lot of pasta because mm-hmm. it was cheap and available. Mm-hmm. And it's what comforts me. It's mm-hmm. what comforts me mm-hmm. when I'm sad and when, you know, when in my time of need,
mm-hmm.
that's always been there. Yeah. It's always something that I can get to, even though I have to replace it with quinoa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, luckily it's still available, but yeah. that might be a mm-hmm. trade-off. I might not be able, like just mm-hmm. the other night, I was really frustrated. I actually had to get like chickpea
mm-hmm.
version because I could not find the quinoa stuff mm-hmm. that I'm used to finding. Mm-hmm. And I don't know when that's going to be available. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, well, what is impacting the gluten-free manufacturing process, mm-hmm. you know? And mm-hmm. so it's going to be very interesting to see yeah. what the kids develop. So I have been conscientious about the food that we have been picking that has been available. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it has been baked goods because, like, you know, my kids are wanting to make food. Like, they're wanting mm-hmm. to pitch in. They're wanting mm-hmm. to, you know, help out because, and partly because they might be bored and that sort of thing. And we do want to encourage it. We want to mm-hmm. foster them. Mm-hmm. I want to do things a little bit differently than was done for me. I don't want to shush them out of the kitchen. Mm-hmm. My husband is really good about that. And mm-hmm. so, like I said, my son baked a gluten-free brownie mm-hmm. mix the other day. He screwed up the liquid portion mm-hmm. of it, but it was fine. Mm-hmm. We still ate it, you know, but this is their opportunity to fail. Mm-hmm. You know, this is their opportunity yeah. to make things. Now, mm-hmm. when they fail, we still have to eat it. We can't waste it, you know, so yeah. it's going to be interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I mean, on the other hand, it's important to fail. Like, I mean, that's how mm-hmm. you learn. Like, I mean, it wasn't yeah. like doubling the liquid. Like, it's not a big deal. Like, I yeah. mean, you can.
He was really upset that. About it. And I reminded him, I was like, it's going to be okay. Yeah. It's going to be fine. That's, I was like, we live time. In Arizona. It'll evaporate.
That's true. Yeah. No. But is that
probably,
like, next time?
Probably needed to use a little bit more water anyway. Mm. You
know? Yeah. No, it's as you said, it's also going to be interesting to see. Like, what are the comfort foods? What are also the foods that they maybe can't see and can't stand anymore? It's like because they either have negative memories because of the quarantine, or it's just like, well, yeah. we had to eat that, whatever, three times a week. Like, and it's like
college, I survived on ramen mm-hmm. and I seriously have like a PTSD response mm-hmm. when someone even mentions ramen. Like, I mm-hmm. know that there is really good ramen out there mm-hmm. that people make. But when I hear ramen, I mm-hmm. just think, oh my God, I was so sick in college. And like, that's what I lived on. And I would have died without it. Yeah. You know, I never want to eat it again.
Yeah. I have that, funny enough. I have that with spaghetti and tomato sauce.
Oh, because is it really? Here all this time I've been talking about spaghetti. No. And you've been drinking.
And I love, I mean, don't get me wrong. I love spaghetti. I like Italian like dishes in general. But uh-huh. my dad used to make every, like, as you said, like for you, it was every Sunday. For me, it was every uh-huh. Saturday. Every Saturday for years and years and years, we made spaghetti and tomato sauce. And there was mm-hmm. one weekend where I had it 5 days in a row because like something was going on, some event was going on, and I had it there.
And it was easy to reheat.
Yeah, it was easy to reheat. So we did like, and I was like, okay, that was enough. And since then, like, I'm staying away from it. I have made pasta. I'm not eating pasta right now because I'm trying to stay away from the sugars. But
that's hard.
It's still like, that dish triggers, as you said, PTSD for me. I'm like, yeah, no, I can't eat mm-hmm. that.
Yeah, see, so for me, what's my comfort food is not your comfort food.
No, it's the opposite.
And, you know, I only ate it that, you know, once a week, mm-hmm. but it's what happened during that once mm-hmm. a week. It's the smells and the sounds, mm-hmm. you know. And so mm-hmm. whenever those things are paired together,
mm-hmm.
so if ever, like, I'm not, my husband isn't a sports guy, so we mm-hmm. don't have sports on, but mm-hmm. when I do hear sports, mm-hmm. and if I've been somewhere, and especially if I smell tomato sauce, mm-hmm. like the combination of tomato sauce and sports, like mm-hmm. I feel instantly like, tired.
You're right.
It's just, it's ASMR for me. Like, I'm just, all right, I need a nap. I didn't even eat anything, but I need a nap because I just smelled it and I heard it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because when I was little, like, that was my favorite thing to do, was after you eat that big plate of spaghetti, you go into like food coma zone, mm-hmm. which is, you know, mm-hmm. probably diabetic response. I would climb up into my dad's lap and I would like take a nap. And mm-hmm. so I just have such fond, fond memories of that. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, I can smell it in my mind's eye, you know. Never mind, it was like, you know, mixed with cigarettes and pipe tobacco, which was all totally unhealthy. But that's like, that's a pleasant memory mm-hmm. for me.
Mm-hmm.
For better or worse.
Mm-hmm. For better or worse. I think we're going to leave it at that. I have like a lot of notes for stuff to talk about in the future. So
they fill your brain.
We definitely have to come back to a lot of other stories.
Maybe I'll have a follow-up where after the quarantine.
Yeah, we're definitely going to do that at some point.
So what foods have survived? hate now?
It will be interesting to see, and we'll definitely do that maybe in a couple of months.
It's food for thought.
Food for thought, yeah. Definitely is. And then I definitely also noted down we're going to have to interview your kids.
Like, yeah.
See what they think and like what their memories are, like cooking with you and cooking with your husband and son.
And what kinds of recipes are they concocting right now?
Yes. Yeah. So thank you so much for doing this and for being here.
Yeah, this is great.
I think we had a lot of really similar. It was really funny. I thought it would be very different. And it ended up like we had a very similar experiences in a lot of areas with like pasta and like Italian influences and so on. I mean, not to the same extent, but it's super interesting for me to hear and to listen to that. So it's funny, like, I mean, different parts of the world and still like somewhat similar experiences.
That's food unites us that way.
It does. It does. So, yeah, thanks for doing this. Tell everybody where they can find you.
You can find me online all over at The Mac Mommy, and I have a website, themacmommy.com. And if you're so inclined, you can tune into the podcast that I do with Elisa and Mike, and it's called The Geekiest Show Ever.
Mm-hmm. Definitely do that. I'm also a big fan of The Mac Mommy. That's, I think, in my book, still the best name ever.
Like, thank you.
Instantly memorable. Like I struggle sometimes to remember your proper name. I'm like, it's the Mac Mommy. Like,
Yep. That's all you need to know. It's like that spaghetti noodle. It sticks. You know?
It does. It does. Yeah. So you can find me all over the webs and everything I do at thepatrice.com. And you can find this very podcast at foodieflashback.com. And at Foodie Flashback on Twitter as well. And if you have another great story to share, just like Melissa just did, or a lot of stories in this case, but we're going to take anything. Foodie or not, doesn't matter. I literally recorded yesterday with someone who, like, I mean, you will already have heard about it now. Like, it was released before this one. So I recorded with Tom, and he's definitely not a foodie. And he still had a lot to talk about and a lot of fun stories. So if you have something like that, then please reach out to me at either on Twitter, or there's a little form on the website, foodieflashback.com. And then I'll be in touch and we'll set something up. And with that, this is the end of the episode. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Manja, manja.
Manja, manja, manja.